It's 3 o'clock.
Imagine no possessions.
But I can't hear her again.
I'm having a problem, Diane.
Diane,
can you hear me?
I can, but I'm getting an echo.
Yeah, I'm going to call in from a different number, okay?
Okay, that's fine. Oftentimes, when you call in with Skype, you get an echo thing unless all your speakers are off and you have a decent headset. I don't know why. It just happens. Well, anyhow, welcome to the premiere episode of The S Word, where Cindy and I have been talking about this project for, a couple months now, and we want to take the stigma out of socialism. And we came up with lots of humorous names for the possibility of this show, but S Word seemed really the most important because socialism is so desperately misused so often. And here we have the other half, and the other half of our team, Cindy Sheehan. Welcome, Cindy.
Hi, Diane. Sorry about that. Technical difficulty earlier. Is this better? I'm not getting an echo like I was before.
I explained to our listeners that sometimes Skype lines will do that complete echo thing. I don't know if it's because the speakers are on or the headset or just they're too busy. Because sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Okay, we'll work out the bugs as we move along. Well, let's start with you. How did you become a socialist? How did you come from just being a liberal to a socialist?
Well, Diane, first of all, I'm very excited about this show that we conceived because there's so much misconception about socialism, of course, out there, and capitalism, and, you know, the dreaded communism that, I'm so glad that we're talking about this and having an intellectual, trying to have intellectual discussions about, what they really are, and having guests on that talk about different aspects of socialism and, you know, what would that look like instead of what we have now? And so anyway, I think I have been a socialist for a long time, but I didn't really know I was a socialist. I really came into focus for me in 2008 when I ran against Nancy Pelosi for her seat in Congress. And you know, we know a lot of people have this other misconception that Nancy Pelosi is some kind of progressive from the, you know, People's Republic of San Francisco, which is just another myth and another lie. She's part of the capitalist class, the ruling class, whatever we want to call it. And so I ran against her, and my platform was very socialist, from free health care, well, you know, a national health care system, free education or education that's provided for people from kindergarten to university, housing as a right, and things like that. And so after I ran against Pelosi as an independent, I ran against her unaffiliated with any party, I just thought, dang it, I'm a socialist. And so I registered with the Peace and Freedom Party here in California, which is at the top, you know, right now. I don't know how much longer it will be, but right now it is a socialist party. And so I recently ran for Vice President of the United States with the Peace and Freedom Party, and the Peace and Freedom Party has a really great comprehensive socialist platform. You know, but what does it mean? You know, what does that really mean? And I'm hoping that with this show that we'll be able to define it and, you know, expand upon that and really have the conversation that needs to be had. And so, Diane, how about yourself?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny that you said, I think I've always been one. I would have to concur. And one of the, even though, you know, it's pretty widely known among my audience, if not yours, that I'm an atheist. One of the little blurbs I put up on the rotating pictures that come up with our show was one of Jesus that says, you know, basically you could explain what he felt in two words, and he's flipping them up and it says, fuck capitalism. When I was a little girl, I was raised Catholic. I went to 12 years of Catholic school, and that's exactly how I lost my religion, is, okay, if you guys believe everything this guy says, yeah, throwing a nickel at the poor once in a while dressing the Pope in gowns and gold and whatever, what the hell? But then, you know, as I went on, I was always a leftist. I was always, I registered as a Democrat when I was a young girl. And, you know, in the 70s, it was considerably lefter than it is now. But as it progressed, I'm like, nobody is even speaking about leftist things anymore. And I watched the Democrats move further right. Well, when I really looked at it, oh, probably, I'm going to say like 25 years ago when I met my husband, or 27, 28, almost 30 now, for God's sakes, he was a, you know, card-carrying communist, you know, leftist. He would run out of line of things. He's like, you know, what he was pretty radical, man. And he influenced my ideas somewhere. But along the lines, I look at, I'm a big picture person. I look at the big pictures and I see what it amounts to. Any regulation is putting Band-Aids on a gaping wound.
Yes.
And like you, I look forward to using this program to, with a sense of humor, with real information, without any spin, describe what socialism really means. And it doesn't mean making us all as poor as the poorest person. It means nobody's poor and nobody is so sickeningly rich that somebody has to die so that they can be that rich.
Right.
You know? That's how I got there.
Well, I have been writing about, you know, this topic for quite a while, and my last published book is called Revolution, A Love Story. And it's about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela and, you know, how that country has been helping equalize the distribution of wealth, how that country has been saying to the oil companies, the international oil oligarchy, that they don't own the oil of Venezuela, the people of the country of Venezuela own that oil, and they're going to use, even though I'm against fossil fuels and I'm against a fossil fuel-based economy, if you have one, to use the profits to improve the lives of all the people and not just the, you know, the international 1%. But when I ran for Congress when I ran for vice president this past year in 2012, I got a note from Sean Hannity from Fox News. His producer said that Sean wanted to have me back on the show. And so I don't like going on Fox News. I don't usually do that. And, you know, unless they're making, you know, unless they're reporting on something about me, I've only been on it once, and that was with Sean Hannity. And so I told his producer, I said, sure, I would love to come on the show, and I would love to tell Sean about how Barack Obama is not a socialist. You know, Sean's always saying that he's a socialist, and even if he were a socialist, what's wrong with that? You know, and so guess what? I never heard back from the producers. They didn't have me on the show. And so...
Yeah, you should have that's a little example, my friends, of too much information. You should have just shown up, said, yeah, I want to come on, and then just drop the bomb on them.
Yeah, I know. I realize that now in hindsight. But so one of the things that we want to talk about too is this you know, this corporate media, they're kind of like, I think since I have all this experience with them, I think that, of course, it's a big plan. It's like wrestling about, you know, who's going to be the spreader of the propaganda in opposition and who's going to spread the propaganda in support of the regime. But it all is basically in support of the regime. And, you know, talk about this, you know, people calling Obama a socialist, and how, to me and to you also, that paints socialism in a very, very bad picture. And when you call, you know, somebody who is practically a fascist
let me jump in there a little bit, Cindy, because one of the aspects to it is that let's talk about socialism as a scare word to start with. People say socialist and everybody goes, you know, not everybody, to the far left like us, it's an affront and an insult to socialism to call that corporate whore that is a president, Barack Obama, a socialist. But to most of the nation, when you say he's a socialist, you are using all the fear-mongering of the McCarthy era all the way through the Cold War that of enemy by saying socialist. And that means anything even remotely, if he writes a law where 99% goes to the corporations and 1% goes to the people, they're going to use that 1% to say, oh, he's evil. They're brainwashing people to say anything good for you is evil and this man is good for you, which he's not. You know what I'm saying? They're demonizing it for the wrong reason. He's not a socialist. We're going to prove that as the weeks and months go on. We're going to prove that definitively. But it's almost like anything remotely socially liberal, if he does something for gays, he's a socialist. Well, no, he's not. He's not. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I kind of jumped in and interrupted you. There's two ways of defining it, and I wanted to hand it back to you. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. And we're co-hosts, so, you know, we should co-do this together. But for example, the healthcare bill. That's an example of what Sean Hannity calls socialist. The healthcare bill doesn't even approach a national healthcare system. It was written, and like you call them a corporate whore, the healthcare bill was written by the insurance companies, and it forces us to purchase a product from a private company. It just provides really crappy healthcare to people who are the most destitute of us. For the rest of us, we have to purchase a private product. How, in the name of this so-called communist Jesus, is that socialist?
No, it's entirely not. For somebody right at the brink, like I am, struggling to keep my home, within like a year and a half, my Social Security ends. From my husband dying, and I won't get it again until, it was originally going to be 55, now it might be 60, who knows. He was a primary wage earner, and I have no, in this job market, I have no marketable skills. My back is too bad to waitress. I'm kind of screwed. But anyhow, buying that insurance is the difference between me having a home or me being homeless. Or living in a hovel somewhere, perhaps. So it may cover a few people, but what it's doing is exactly what you said. It was written by the insurance companies, and it was written by Big Pharma. Because, again, you might get the treatment, but there's no guarantee you can afford the pills. I know firsthand what the cost of cancer treatment is. I went through that with my husband. I accrued a lot of bills after he had insurance through the first part of it, then his boss, had to let him go off the insurance after he hadn't worked for so long, his insurance. not because he wanted to, because the insurance company caught him. And I ended up with a shitload of medical bills that, you know, some of which were absorbed by the hospital, some of which I still am dealing with. This is not anything remotely socialist. I mean, all right, let's go back. What is socialism? I mean, the basic idea of socialism is common ownership. This means, like, the resources of the world should be owned in common by the entire world. When you've been in Venezuela. Now, what Venezuela, you brushed across the oil economy, and I wish they'd reinvest that in getting off the oil economy, because really the carbon is getting so high that it's not going to matter what kind of system we have if the climate changes that badly. But he's also competing in a global economy that's capitalist. So he is forced to have any money whatsoever to sell that oil to somebody. Rather than it be a world economy, if it was global socialism, it would be nothing for people like, you know, any of the people of the oil-producing countries to get off of it and to produce power that's clean and effective. But they have to compete in this market, and this is insanity. It's driving us to extinction.
Well, and that's true. And, you know, there are some activists in Venezuela who are urging the government to, you know, transition from a fossil fuel-based economy to something that is more healthy. But, however, you know, there's also a problem with Venezuela, because Venezuela is not a socialist country like Cuba is. Venezuela, they call it socialism for the 21st century. And so, you know, many of us socialists around the world and around the planet, even though we admire Hugo Chavez's strides he's made for everybody in Venezuela, you know, we know that a mixed economy can't exist. Capitalist, socialist economy can't for a long time exist. And so we're hoping that Chavez recovers his health and makes with he did get a mandate the last election. He won by over 10 percentage points in elections that are free and fair and transparent, where there wasn't one reported incidence of voter fraud. So for the people in our government to say that he's a dictator or his elections are compromised is just a bunch of bullshit. And so anyway, we do hope that economy can make a quicker transition to a socialist economy. But you made a wonderful list of people that Obama has appointed to his government from Wall Street. And I was reading an article today about his nominee for the Treasury Department, Jack Lew, and how Jack Lew got this $1 million bonus after the people of the United States gave Citicorp a huge bailout. And what was Jack Lew's bonus for? Getting a high-level position in the U.S. government. So,
oh, my God.
Yeah. Did you? I know.
Really?
Do you want to go over that list? Yes, really.
Well, you know, I mean, here we have Obama the socialist. And right from day one, when he put Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff, anybody who remotely thought this man was left-wing had to have their eyes peeled open and acid poured in them. But no, they apologized for him. The ones who love him apologized for him. Even the right-wing people that he fills his appointments with, people from Goldman Sachs, these are all Goldies on this list. They're all... He's still a bad man. Why? Because he's not quite fascist enough for you with his kill list and his drones and the giveaway to the banks. I'm not familiar with all the names on the list, but all of these people have worked for or gotten money from Goldman Sachs, including him and Biden himself. But, you know, you've got Warren Buffett. You've got Hillary Clinton. You've got Gregory Craig. Steve Friedman, Tim Geithner, I mean, Duke
right.
DeJour, Gephardt, Greenstone, Kagan herself, Elena Kagan. She was big, deep, fat ass in it's buried in the economy, the banking economy group. Kornbluh, Liddy, Minder, Ratner, Reischauer, two Rubens, a Chaplin, and a Summers, Larry Summers. We all just love Larry Summers, right?
Right.
It reads like the rogues gallery of capitalist right-wing people that are part of the 1% want to extract everything they can from you. They put, as Glenn Ford likes to say, a happy, shiny face on capitalist fascism. He's the more effective evil. He's outbushing Bush, and it's not just on foreign policy, which is abysmal. We'll talk about war, I'm sure, in length, but in domestic policy as well. How can people see this? And there was another bailout today of sorts. Oh, my God.
Another bailout today? I didn't hear about that.
Right as I was going on air, somebody sent me a link. I didn't have time to peruse it, but from what I understand, go to either my page or Cindy's page, Diane G or Cindy Sheehan on Facebook later. I will pull up the link that somebody sent me, and I will post it. The fact of the matter is, Obama, not a socialist. He is the furthest thing from it. Between healthcare, the banking, let's talk about what a socialist would do when, for no reason other than the extraction of goods, and including, up to and including his chief of staff and the head honchos of the military, with the AFRICOM thing, they flat out said, we need to extract those resources from that country. That is not a socialist idea. That's ours. We have a right to it. We're going to go in there. We're going to bomb them into compliance. We're going to send our multinational corporations in there, and we're going to suck that money out for our rich. You and I, and I can't, you can walk down any street in America and say, do you have anything against Somalia or Mali? Or, well, Somalia they might because of the pirates, but Mali. Or name Muslims can't even name five countries in Africa. Do you have anything against those people? Have they done it? And they'd say no. Do you want to go to war with them? Do you want your son over there and shoot them? And they'd say no. But they're going to sell it to us as terrorists, whatever, blah, 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 because it has to feed capitalism. War feeds capitalism, and keeping people down feeds capitalism, period.
Well, and, let's just take Hugo Chavez, for example. There's very few countries that, besides Cuba, that are more socialist than Venezuela. There are social democracies, but, let's face it, Germany and France, they're very capitalist and very aggressive imperialist. I mean, Mali is a French operation that the U.S. is more than happy to assist them in. Obama is involved in 35 African countries where there are U.S. troops right now. So could Bush have gotten away with that without a peep? Could McCain or Romney have gotten away with that without a peep? I don't think so. But, people... Cuba and Venezuela are not occupying any other countries. They're not aggressive. The one military adventure that Cuba did have in Angola, was it Angola, was to help the freedom fighters there. So, it's just amazing that socialism could be equated with this very aggressive foreign policy, where true socialists respect the sovereignty of other countries and want their sovereignty respected. And one of our listeners, Brian Smith, said Chavez got to return to Venezuela today. Viva Chavez! And yes, he did get to return to Venezuela from Cuba and his cancer surgery. So, like I said, we're all hoping that he makes a full recovery, not just for the people of Venezuela, but even though he doesn't have an aggressive foreign policy, Venezuela has been able to improve the lives of many people around the world, not just Venezuelans, but, you know, he uses his resources to make life better, not just in other countries, but here in the United States, where Citgo was the only oil company that stepped up when they when oil companies were asked to provide low or no cost or heavily subsidized heating oil to poor people in the Northwest. So we're hoping that Chavez does recover so we can continue to be inspired by the Bolivarian Revolution and his work.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that when we talk about socialism, and, you know, even before we get in, we will at some point in the future talk about the nuances between all the different levels of socialists and communists and tried and failed experiments, the leaders of the past. I mean, everybody gets hung up on their guru and wants to fight with other people with their gurus, economic leaders. But Chavez, if nothing else, his absolute presidency has been nothing but democratic. Every time he wants to move a new social program in, he goes out and he's, all right, we're going to have a vote on it. And if he hasn't sold the people, he goes out and tries to sell it again. Or lets a municipality try it if they choose to try it. And then once it shows its success, the other people, then they have another national referendum on it. Cuba, today a report came out, and again, I didn't have time to fight all of this. Cuba had a report come out that by 2015, they will have zero poverty and zero children living in poverty. Okay, they've eliminated poverty entirely. Really?
Right.
We've gone from almost none in the last 50 years to 1 in 4 is food challenged in the United States. Tell me we're doing it right.
Right. We're number one in a lot of things, but nothing good. And Cuba has eliminated childhood hunger, totally eliminated childhood hunger. And Cuba is number two in the world in literacy. The United States isn't even, you know, in the top 10. And we know that our education system is failing because it's based on profit, and also it's heavily subsidized by Big Pharma, the military-industrial complex, Monsanto and GMOs, and I can't wait to have a show on Monsanto and GMOs that we can have up to talk about that. So anyway, there's so many things that we could do here in the United States, I think, that would improve the lives of everybody in this country, not just the 1%. And to do that, we're going to have to eliminate our wars and our bases and the money we give to the Pentagon and the police state. And hopefully pretty soon we'll have Ruth Hull, our guest, on to talk about that police state and what's happening.
And the police state is a very, very deep and integral part of being able to enforce capitalism and extract from us. I have a caller on the line, Cindy. I'm not positive if it's Ruth or not. If it is, well, you know, we will move this conversation forward. If not, we'll see what question they have for us.
Okay.
Welcome to the S-Word. Who have I got on the line, please?
Capitalism is the fucking best.
Okay. Okay. That was what they wanted to say.
I don't think that was Ruth.
No, I don't either. What she's saying, it's the bitch isn't good or it's a bitch isn't bad. I'm not quite sure what that meant.
Did she say it's the best or a bitch?
I thought she said it's a bitch. But, you know, it's all good. Yeah. Whatever. Anyhow, we're going to be talking tonight with Ruth Hull. She'll be calling in shortly, I believe. We wanted to talk a little bit about the case that happened this week that started out as a chase scene for Chris Dorner, then a shootout scene for Chris Dorner, and everybody in the media, except us tonight, wants to talk about what kind of person he was, what he presumably did, arguably did or did not, and see him either as a hero or a villain. I want to do neither. I want to do none of the three because there's been no trial, there's been no evidence, and there's been no investigative reporting. But what I do want to talk about with Cindy is the fact, and I wrote an article about it this week, what it bodes for the state of citizens in these United States when an ultimate army of people come out to get one man, who may or may not have been there, and burn the fucking place to the ground rather than try and apprehend him and give him a trial. So, you know, you see this, you've been arrested numerous times, Cindy, and you take reports about Occupy and about other people, and you're highly aware, as are hopefully most of our audience. What do you think about encroaching police state?
Well, I think that,
I think I have her on the line. You want to hold that for a second?
Let's go to her. I think most police are class traitors, by the way. I'm not going to say 100% of police are class traitors, but I think most of them are.
Well, welcome to the S Word. Do I have Ruth Hall on the line?
Yes, you do. Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm wonderful, Ruth. I'm Diane G. Thanks for coming on, and I'll let you say hello to Cindy.
Hi, Ruth. This is Cindy. Thank you for being on.
Well, thank you. First, I wanted to say to thank you for creating this and for getting out the truth about health care in Venezuela, the Obama administration, the military. You are a genuine hero, and I really appreciate all the great work you've done. We all owe you a debt of gratitude.
Oh, thank you. And, Ruth, I think your phone is cutting out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hope you got the part where I'm very grateful for all the great work you've done.
Oh, I got that part. Thank you.
Let me pop in and let our listeners know who you are. I came across your articles when I was researching a long article that I wrote about the actual chase scene when they got Chris Horner. And I have to say that you are a wonderful writer. Ruth Hall is an activist. She's a great writer. Her career has included work as a criminal defense attorney, a licensed private investigator, and an educator. We're not talking about an average blogger here. We're talking somebody who is trained in observation, trained to use evidence, and somebody who doesn't have necessarily an agenda, who ended up on scene and firsthand observed what was going on. And you've been on this since the beginning, Ruth. I mean, in The Hunt, you wrote about Maggie Carranza and Emma Hernandez, both of them who were mistaken for Chris Dorner. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it seemed very clear from the start that they were eager to kill this gentleman. I would like to mention about the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, because this man has not been indicted or tried or found guilty. And yet, you know, under the Constitution of the United States, this man is legally innocent. And yet they were shooting to kill. They shot two innocent women, as you mentioned, Maggie Carranza and Emma Hernandez. Emma Hernandez was a 71-year-old woman. They were delivering newspapers. Yet they were willing to just fire at them in their truck. They also rammed another truck of a different color almost right afterwards, a clear indication that they were eager to kill. The other thing is that we have no real proof that he killed anyone. There's no parking garage video. Monica Kwan was the daughter of the gentleman who tried to help him maintain his badge. Her boyfriend, Keith Lawrence, was a Fullerton police officer. It's quite possible that the three of them were working together to get proof about real police corruption and to maybe get him back his badge. We do not know what happened in that parking garage. And so, you know, there are a lot of questions regarding this case. We do know that there are two manifestos, at least, In the first one, he was concerned about police abuse against innocent suspects or against suspects in general, and he documented a number of abuses that he witnessed firsthand. He expressed that he was not concerned about the U.S. government, and yet in the second manifesto, which appears to have been written to sensationalize him in the news media, is talking about drone bombings and gun control and all kinds of other issues that were of no concern to him. It was also written in a style that he would not have written. He expressed in the original manifesto, and we don't know that he actually wrote any of the manifestos, but
right,
the original
right.
manifesto...
And I read both, and the styles were, as a writer, the styles were impressively different. I concur that.
Yeah. Okay, good. When I was up on the mountain, one thing I did discover was a tremendous amount of discrepancy in the police information. I was talking to the Fish and Wildlife Services. They were the ones who fired the first shot. Now, there was a public information officer who had Dorner going up the mountain in the SUV towards Big Bear, theoretically after stealing the vehicle from Big Bear. And then there was Officer or Lieutenant Foy, who had Dorner going down the mountain. So you had these two discrepancies in the story as if they had not solidified their story. And then the two officers had the truck that he supposedly later obtained being shot on two different roads. One of them had it shot on 38, and the other one had it shot on Glass Road. Now, Glass Road would have been closer to the cabin, so that's more likely the more correct version. But the one thing that was clear is that they did not have a solid story. It seemed as if they were making it up as they went along. I also noticed a great deal of racial profiling. It seemed like the reason they thought it was Dorner was that he was big and black. And I got a lot of statements about how there are no black men in this area.
May I jump in here a little bit? One thing I would like to tell our listeners is a friend of mine who shall remain nameless is a former special ops man. He has told me, and he did look up the level of training that Chris Dorner had in the military, and is absolutely certain that in no way, no matter how bad he is hurt, would Chris have gone into a cabin with basically trapping himself. It goes against every bit of military training there ever has been. Now, you had written that one of the accounts said within 3 to 4 minutes, the pickup was shot up and dropped down 20 to 30 feet off of a mountainside. Now, if that being the case, he would have run, for number one. And for number two, and I'm going to at one point read the transcript because I actually transcribed one of those audios from the police. He couldn't possibly have been carrying all those guns, all that ammunition, let alone an RPG. Now we're shot up and we've fallen off a mountain. Talk about the credibility of who you heard that story from and what you thought of it.
I got the...
Thank you.
Nice to meet you. We're getting a little background noise, but go ahead.
Okay, about the speed of it. Actually, it was the public information officer, Hugham, who told me 3 or 4 minutes. But actually, the article was truncated a little bit. He said from the time they saw the SUV to the time that the truck was shot at was 3 to 4 minutes. And you have him hijacking a second vehicle during that time. That did not seem that credible, the information. There's other information that seems highly incredible. One was the wallet situation that was found supposedly twice in San Diego County. The badge, which he would have lost as a police officer, which was found in a dumpster in National City. Now, you've lived in California. You know what's between San Diego and Big Bear. There are checkpoints, Border Patrol checkpoints on every major highway. Why would he leave San Diego to go to a Border Patrol checkpoint to go up to Big Bear?
Right. You wouldn't.
Expound on that. I'm not all my listeners are from California, and I'm from Michigan. there's checkpoints to go up to Big Bear in California?
There are checkpoints by Oceanside, but San Clemente and Temecula and on essentially every other major highway leading from San Diego to Big Bear because they want to catch anyone who might be coming up from the border.
Right, so it's Border Patrol.
Yes.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes.
Yes, and he would have had to have crossed one of those checkpoints to go up to Big Bear. And yet, in San Diego, he was much closer to safety in Mexico. And if there really was that much racial profiling going on in Big Bear, why would he go up there when he could have more easily hidden out in San Diego and waited for a chance to cross the border?
Yeah, that goes against every logical, you know, idea, and it goes against military training. I mean, if he was to go up there, I believe you wrote this, why not don ski clothes and just try and blend in until the heat was off?
Right, exactly. It did not make any sense. The other thing we need to look at is the reward. $1 million reward was offered. This reward is not available to police officers, but is available to civilians, like the owners of the SUV and Rick Hadelbrink, the owner of the truck. Now, that is a big incentive. I'm not saying that they're not telling the truth about seeing a big black man, but on the other hand, that is a major incentive. A lot of people would see the right individual for $500,000 or $1 million.
Hey, Ruth, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read through some of the audio evidence, and then and I'm going to do it line by line, and I'm going to opine on it and then give you a chance to opine on it. Right now, Cindy has to deal with her granddaughter for a moment. They started out with number three side, heads up, we're boarding the 1-2. Now, I know enough about copies and whatever. This means they're entering the cabin from that side. They didn't want to be shot at by their team. We're moving in. This was followed immediately, folks, by them saying, tear that whole wall down, that door, and that window. Make a big port window for me there. Now, they're close enough to the cabin to start tearing down the wall, and there was no fear from any, at no point did they say, take caution, I'm person inside, danger, 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 which every police scanner would if they thought they had an armed and dangerous perp inside. They didn't say anything about the suspect or seem to worry about it at all. And then they discuss briefly what's inside the front door, and one guy says, confirms it's a couple trash bags. He's calm. He's inside. And then he says, quote, the blood splatters in the far corner. Okay, whose blood? Ah, you got a couple of mattresses laying up against the bed. Now, without going further, what did you think when you heard that much?
I thought that they had planned the fire, possibly to destroy evidence. It seemed like a really serious situation, so not just the foxes guarding the hen house, but torching the hen house, too, to destroy the evidence, you know, as to who killed the hens. One thing that can be destroyed in these fires are the powder burns. And why was the wallet supposedly intact, as a deputy sheriff of the USA Today reporter, I heard it in the bathroom as she was talking about it, if the body was burned to a crisp? There are so many questions. It was as if they needed to torch the body for a reason.
Oh, yeah, because then they get to the point where he says, okay, Steve, we're going to go forward with the plan with the burn. Copy.
Yes.
I want it all like we talked about.
Yes.
This means premeditation to me.
To me, too. And if he was alive, if they had any suspicion he was alive, we do have the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which involves cruel and unusual punishment. I would think torching somebody alive would be cruel and unusual punishment, even especially if he hasn't been convicted of a crime. Especially back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah, it's essentially they're throwing out the Constitution. I found this to be basically a public lynching. What it was is, I don't know if Chris Turner was ever in that cabin. I don't know if he's been dead for weeks or if he's still alive and on the run. I don't hold any of those to be true, and I don't give anyone any more weight than the other because there's no evidence. What I do know is that the United States public was treated to what amounted to a witch burning or a beheading or a lynching. A bunch of people gathered around this cabin. They're on the radio saying, like we talked about, punch a hole, send in the burners. That was next. The burners are deployed. We have a fire. Copy, Seven. The burners are deployed. We have a fire. As you said, there's no reason to burn this building that they've already entered and they've already cleared other than to destroy evidence.
Yeah.
Can I say something? I'm back. This is
yay.
Cindy. To me, this whole incident like has so many parallels to other unexplained or ill-explained incidents in, you know, not just recent American history, but American history. But a lot of people have equated the finding the wallet again for the second time with the passport of one of mm-hmm. the supposed hijackers that survived the World Trade Center bombings. And also this whole Christopher Dorner thing reminds me of the Osama bin Laden, you know, so-called recent execution of Osama bin Laden that's been, you know, written, it's in the movies now in that Zero Dark Thirty horrible movie, you know. And another thing that I have equated the Dorner thing with, and you know, I'm almost finished, Ruth, and you can comment on what I'm saying, is right before the whole this whole Dorner situation, another Christopher Kyle was killed, the sniper, and he admitted killing almost 200 people in cold blood with no remorse. And he is given this hero's funeral with tens of thousands of people at the funeral. And he, of course, is being celebrated by everybody for being a stone cold killer. But Dorner allegedly killed a few people, and he's public enemy number one. So, Ruth, can you comment on all those broad statements I just made?
Well, there are a couple of things. I'm going to go back to the audio, though. Listen to it again. Did you hear any gunshots going on off as they're torching the cabin? Because there's no indication of any danger other than the torching of the cabin, like, as you mentioned, it's a plan. Then back to the funeral issue. You know, a movie producer couldn't have planned a better movie. Here you have this enormous funeral of praying at the same time that they're supposedly trying to get the remains out of the cabin. This had to be something made in Hollywood. And if you look at, you know, my last article, you know, I have pictures of all the news media doing their filming. In fact, there was one guy who was standing out in a suit all night, Tuesday night. He had to be wearing thermal underwear because of the way he was dressed. You know, just filming, you know, all night, you know, his words. And this was a big media circus. And we're going to see probably movie after movie coming out. And with the funeral and everything, it was almost as if they had produced it all in advance.
Briefly,
that my special ops friend that I told you about, when I was watching it, I made a comment to him in chat. And I said, that's not the same cabin. Look at the tree line. And he, being what he does, sent me a screenshot of his two different computers with the original cabin that they had shown and the engulfed cabin when they finally allowed close-ups. And they were not the same cabin. They did not have the same skyline. They did not have the highway. And they did not have the same, you know, immediate surroundings, including the original cabin had a bunch of cabins around it. This other cabin was burning separately. And he said, oh, this is so psyops. I mean, this is a former person admitting that this is psyops.
Really? You know, that's interesting because Brett Behrens, the son of the owner of the Oak Restaurant where we were all hanging out, was talking about how he had seen it, and it looked, you know, he believed that was like a center for, you know, a group of cabins, and that, you know, it was about 3,000 square feet on the bottom, maybe, you know, and two-story. Whereas the PIO officer seemed to think that it was much smaller, And that would explain why we're hearing different stories as to what size the cabin was.
Yes. Cindy, I'm sorry. Do you want to jump in?
Hello?
Hello.
Did you say something to me? I'm sorry.
I just wondered if you wanted to jump back in.
I made my comments about my feelings about the Dorner case. So if Ruth wants to comment on, you know, the similarities between the wallet and the passport and the Osama bin Laden thing and, you know, the Sandy Hook incident coming, you know, not too distant from this Chris Dorner thing. It does seem like the tail wagging the dog to me. I'm not in love with every conspiracy theory like some people I know, but it seems very suspicious.
Yeah.
All this stuff seems very suspicious to me.
Yeah, Cindy, the telling line for me, and one of the last lines I transcribed, was when the officer in charge told everybody in the field to remember their backdrops. Now, if you've ever met a cop in your life, you know what a backdrop is. It is an unregistered gun that you leave behind to make certain that it looks like a good kill. If you kill an unarmed man, you have a backdrop, or you call for one. And he told the people on scene so that when they did pick through the debris, there would be backdrops in there to justify what they did. That, to me, says what we... Did you see smoke, Ruth, when you were there? Did you see a pillar of smoke?
Not only did I not see smoke, nobody I talked to in the area... I was about 6 miles away. That's where they were holding us up. Nobody there had seen smoke. Nobody there had actually heard the gunshots, but they were saying that, you know, maybe because it was 6 miles away, we couldn't. But I talked to other officers who said, well, we've just arrived, but some of them were coming from that direction. They hadn't seen smoke or anything along that line. So it was very odd. And one of the officers, as well as one of the Caltrans workers, was saying it was odd that they had closed 38 because the cabin was way off of 38. And so we were having, you know, a lot of, you know, interesting comments and discrepancies there. One thing I did want to mention is, you know, as Cindy pointed out about the passport, Muhammad Atta's passport, and then the, you know, undamaged wallet. How is it possible that the cabinet burned to a crisp and the body charred and this wallet, which he didn't even have on him, appears in the rubble undamaged? And, you know, if it was found in San Diego, it had to be planted by somebody who did it. And if they planted the wallet, what else did they plant? Because once you cross a certain line of dishonesty, how far will you go? I mean, you know, that's one problem I have with some of the news media. A lot of the news media has stood down on this issue. There was possibly, if Dorner was alive, you know, the weekend before, there was time to save lives by telling the truth about how the second manifesto was a fake. And yet... it was so obvious to be a fake, and yet even the liberal media stood down because they wanted to get through things like gun control. I mean, I'm for gun control, but not at the expense of people's lives. Same thing with Sandy Hook. There are so many questions there, and nobody's saying it didn't happen. We just want to have some answers to some of the questions. Why is there nobody video footage in school, for instance? What about the second and third gunmen that they supposedly caught? So information like that. We just like answers. But everybody who's asked questions about Sandy Hook is being called a gun nut, even if they could never even consider owning a gun, and are opposed to the NRA. So the liberal media is actually, you know, and I'm not saying that the media is liberal. The mainstream media is not. But there is an alternative liberal media that has stood down on all of these recent issues. And I think it's the job of the media to stand up and actually ask the hard-hitting questions. Because
you're breaking up again a little bit, dear. I don't know if it's your location in your house or if there's something you can do to make yourself clear again, but
okay.
You are breaking up a little bit again.
Okay. I was just trying to say that it's very important for the media to tell the truth when lives are at stake. because there's no agenda that is as important as saving lives.
Well, this is a very good topic. The police state. This is the police state on a local level. What we're talking about, but of course, it was a national story. And like Ruth has said, and Diane has said, Dorner was tried and convicted and executed, without any transparency, without any evidence. And this is what Obama, the so-called socialist, is doing on a national level. Mm-hmm. He has a kill list. He's the one that evaluates the evidence along with his Dick Cheney, Brenner, and he decides if people should be assassinated or indefinitely detained or whatever. So, this is a story that has national, international implications, and it just shows how easily many people our society can be fooled and fooled over and over and over again with all of these questionable activities. So it's been fascinating to talk about this case that to me is just so fraught with inconsistencies, but also that we can extrapolate it to the wider issue of Obama's increasing police state. It's not a slippery slope. We're all the way down the hill mm-hmm. on this when you can execute people and it's just taken for granted that they were guilty.
I added a little bit of time to the show, ladies. We don't have to go way over, but I also don't want to rush to an unnatural conclusion. I want to ask Ruth, when you were there, what did I assume you were there with a lot of press, and policemen were wandering in. Here's the crux of conspiracy theory, and I'm not a conspiracy big CT person. How did the press act, and B, did the police seem knowledgeable or sneaky at all? We're talking, this would have to be a conspiracy on a massive scale, or they would have had to keep most of them far enough away and ignorant enough and off of the radio enough to really not know what was going on either. So, all right, you're trained in observation. What was your observation of both the complicity of the press and how the people feeding the press were acting on scene?
Well, as I mentioned, I overheard, one of the USA Today reporters mention in the bathroom that, she had heard about the intact wallet from a deputy sheriff. But most of the people on the scene were the fish and game people were there who were involved in the initial shooting, Fish and Wildlife. But, the sheriff was missing. And the reason the sheriffs were missing was so that they wouldn't have to talk about it. And the officers that were there were giving conflicting reports. The CHP seemed completely unaware of what was going on. They hadn't heard any gunfire. They hadn't seen any smoke. Caltrans was in a position of I don't know. And so it looked like they were trying to, minimize the amount of information the press got as we were getting fed, information they were making up as they went along. It did seem as if they were making up as they went along. When the PIO came over to me, he said, I have a story to tell you. And it seemed like it really was a story. I think they were nice guys, but I think that was their job, to handle the press.
Oh, yeah. I don't even fall for that good cop, bad cop bullshit anymore.
I think a lot of the press, was just interested in the media circus. They were not half as interested in what happened to the guy as they were in, the show, actually.
You've made some pretty strong ideas of what the motives could have been and what could have happened. And again, I really hate to speculate without evidence because
I have not actually said what happened. I've got some guesses.
And what are your guesses?
My guesses, Well, you know, I have no evidence, so there is, you know, no way to say this, but it would not surprise me if Dorner was shot in the parking garage, of which there is no video, along with his, you know, maybe his friends Monica and Keith, you know, as they were trying to get evidence against the LAPD. Maybe they, you know, maybe if there were three bodies there, they figured they had to do something. This guy might have been put on ice. Now, this is all speculation, and this is what a defense attorney might say.
Let me pause you there. Wouldn't the easiest thing to do, say he shot them both and shot himself, unless they wanted this little circus to make people afraid of confronting the cops or whistleblowing, as they've done with Bradley Manning for the military, now they need to do it among the police.
That is another possibility. I have no idea what happened. You know, when I'm saying that might be a guess, you know, I'm also, you know, part of me is hoping that maybe he did make it down to Mexico. Because as of right now, under the Constitution of the United States, this man is legally innocent. And it would be better if this legally innocent man were alive, somewhere safe, than if he were dead, in a, you know, having been, you know, burned in a cabin or shot.
Yes, I agree.
Cindy, I mean, you talk a lot about the precedent, and, you know, overall, I mean, we know that austerity is coming. I mean, it is, you know, if you read any of the economic, you know, gurus from Taibbi on down, it is, right now they're holding it together with strings and Elmer's glue. Doesn't it seem to you that, like, okay, let's say we start food riots somewhere because, you know, the economy's collapsed. Now that they've already done this once, is it a stretch to say that they drone a neighborhood or cordon it off and burn it? Because, you know, it's collateral damage, because they do that. They do that elsewhere in the world, and it's become normalized to us.
It's, well, you know, absolutely. And I just think that we should take our cues from the people in Greece who are fighting the 1%. They're fighting austerity measures, and they're doing, you know, on February 20th, they're going to do a general strike, you know, which is like this total weird concept here in the United States. But I have, there's a question from one of our listeners, Green. He says, what was the demeanor of the cops prior to the shooting? I'm just wondering if they knew that he was already dead. Ruth?
I did not see the cops prior to the shooting. I came up there, you know, it was the cabin was already burning when I got up to the Big Bear area.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got as far as Angeles Oaks on Big Bear Mountain. So I don't know what their demeanor was prior to, but if you look at what happened with Torrance, you have a wild frenzy of officers shooting at everything in sight. You know, why would they shoot two women? They look nothing like Dorner.
That's another
this
whole thing.
And that could be also why they did the manifesto, if they faked it, to try and terrorize the other officers into just firing first so that nobody would ask any questions.
I agree with that. And I also think that if, in fact, this was a PSYOPS operation in any way, and there are think tanks, and I'm not a big CT person. I think very few people knew except the people closest, because I don't think that they could make the, oh, say, 4,000 people on scene all, you know, part of a conspiracy. It's too convoluted to be a conspiracy. I think people had to be ignorant, including the surrounding cops. However, if I was to make a PSYOP thing, knowing what was happening in Greece, what happened in Tunisia, what happened in the Arab Spring, and even what happened in some places on Occupy Wall Street, revolution is only successful when the young men of the military or the police turn against the people giving them orders to shoot their peers and join their peers. I think if this is a perfect PSYOP saying, okay, if you're wearing the blue, this is what the blue comes out and does to you if you turn against us.
Well, it's a terror. It was a program of Blue Terror, and someone said, oh, you know, they were saying that Chris Dorner was terrorizing Los Angeles. Actually, the LAPD was terrorizing Los Angeles. So, you know, it is just a big program of terror. And what are they getting us ready for? And, you know, that's just a big discussion that really needs to happen. And what should be our response to it, I think, is the most important thing that we should be discussing and could be discussing.
Absolutely. We have time for a caller. If you want to call in, anybody wants to call in, 646-929-1264. We're about to wrap up the night. But if you have a question for either of our co-hosts or our guest, Ruth, call in now, and we'll bring you on the line. Ruth, do you have anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Actually, I really appreciate that you guys did this show. We do need to get out the truth. This man has a mother who probably is sitting there wondering if, you know, how she could have raised somebody who could kill people, and yet he might not even be a killer. We don't know
that.
That's
another thing about his mother. Did you read that his mother was just drinking margaritas in a Mexican restaurant in Orange County while they had the TV of the cabin burning going? Did you read about that? Do you think there's any truth to that?
I don't know. That's a very strange reaction, though, don't you think?
Very strange. Super duper strange, I would think. I mean, I know how parents who lose a child act, and I know that there's no script for shock, but, you know, if that story's true, that just adds another weird dimension to this whole thing.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that at all. That's absurd.
Yeah, there was a reporter in this restaurant, and she saw what looked like Chris Dorner's mother, and then went to Chris Dorner's house after the whole thing happened, and the same lady pulled up into the house. So it was his mother.
Yeah.
Well, she was just calmly drinking margaritas and eating tortilla chips or something like that, while they had his cabin burning. And, well, we all saw the coverage. She was looking at the same coverage, you know, drinking and eating Mexican food. Was super duper weird.
I know you and I would be going crazy.
Well, yeah, kind of. I would be in my car driving up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't even know the man, and I was driving up there because I was concerned about him as a human being.
Exactly.
Well, all we do know is that the fact that the wallet was found in three places, they cleared the cabin and went in there, so he wasn't alive when they burned that cabin. They were burning evidence. I mean, that stands, I mean, for proof. But the real question and the thing that I want to, you know, reiterate to our listeners is that what world do we live in when even a guilty person isn't brought in for justice? Do we not have a justice system made for this? Where it's totally okay for the cops to just say, burn the motherfucker, which was the other audio from the police department. They were screaming at somebody, get down, and then there's like, burn the motherfucker. I'm sorry. I thought that we actually had a constitution here.
Yeah, well, I have to go, ladies, because I do have a conference call for my Tour de Peace coming up, and that's at tourdepeace.org. And so I think that this was a wonderful first episode of the S Word. And Ruth, thank you so much for being on and sharing with us what you have investigated and actually seen on scene there. And Diane, thanks for setting this up, and I look forward to many, many more awesome shows. This is Cindy Sheehan, and every week at 3 p.m. Pacific on Monday, right, Diane?
Absolutely.
Okay, love you guys.
Your blog, love you too. Give us what your blog is and where people can find you and read you.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I just write for different news services. Lately, I've been writing some for activistpost.com. I've also written 99 articles that are up for opEdNews.com too.
Well, thank you for coming on tonight. And now they know where to find you, and I'll put up the links on blahblahblah.com. And I hope to hear from you again. Thanks, Ruth.
I thank you very much.
Have a beautiful night.
You have a beautiful night.
Everybody, and you can find us here every Monday night at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific Crew Time, and every time in between. Thanks for staying over, and have a great night. Oh man, it's a battle, but you know what? Socialism and us getting out the word is totally, totally worth it. Good night, everyone.
Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. Our brotherhood.